China is in the grip of a fresh wave of COVID. Millions of people are getting infected by a new subvariant.
What we know with COVID is the virus doesn't go away. It keeps changing, and that means it keeps coming back again and again.
Also today, Pacific Island nations are upset with Japan. They're saying no to the dumping of nuclear waste from Fukushima into the ocean.
It opposes our worldview that, you know, people should live in harmony with the environment and the ocean.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, we celebrate the international impact of the late Tina Turner and the success of Ukrainian punk rockers who refuse to sing in Russian.
Our popularity started with the son Tansi. When we played this song, it was like explosion. Oh, people, they came crazy.
All that and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us this Thursday. It has not been that long since the WHO declared the end to the global pandemic emergency, but today China is in a new wave of a COVID subvariant that is already infecting tens of millions of people every week. Just 6 months ago, Chinese authorities were enforcing a strict zero COVID policy. Lockdowns and near daily testing were common. But at the end of last year, officials lifted many of the policies following unprecedented protests against the strict controls. Ben Cowling is a professor of epidemiology at the University of Hong Kong School of Public Health. This latest COVID wave in China, Ben, it's the Omicron subvariant XBB. It's already found widely in the U.S. What's it likely going to mean for China?
This is now a new variant, and it's causing reinfections in people who just 4 or 5 months ago had their first ever COVID infection in China. We know infections are on the increase. There are some severe cases in there. There's some deaths, unfortunately. Overall, the impact's likely to be lower than what happened in December and January, of course, because that was an enormous wave. I don't think anywhere in the world will top what happened in that wave in terms of the number of infections. But certainly there is going to be a wave. And what we've seen around the world is every 3, 4, 5 months, there's another wave of COVID. Now, China's earlier in its pattern with COVID because they just had their first big Omicron wave over the new year, whereas other countries have been having COVID for years. So they're a bit less experienced with COVID in terms of the population immunity, but there's likely to be a lot of infections in the coming weeks.
Yeah, so how are Chinese officials and citizens reacting to this uptick and upcoming wave?
I think there's a lot of concern. There was a perception that after that December-January wave, when, remember, there were 80 or 90% of the population infected, there was a perception that it's over, that that's it, they've had COVID, and that's the end. But what we know with COVID is the virus doesn't go away. It keeps changing, and that means it keeps coming back again and again. And so the threat that it poses to public health hasn't gone to zero. It's still there, maybe more comparable to flu now, but that's definitely a threat.
So you said this new wave probably won't be too severe in terms of like symptoms, but does modeling tell us anything more specific about how severe it could be?
No, I think it's very difficult to judge exactly how many severe cases there might be, how many deaths there might be. We know it'll be much less in terms of the severe cases than the December-January wave, but I don't think it'll be a low number.
So what measures are Chinese officials taking this time around? Maybe a return to some of the draconian policies? Is that possible?
I don't think so at this moment. I don't think much will be done in terms of the community measures, the public health and social measures. I haven't heard much about a booster vaccine campaign. We know for older people, having a booster every 6 to 12 months can help. I wish more will be done on that. And I haven't heard much about antiviral availability. So Paxlovid, the best antiviral we have for COVID, Paxlovid is available in China, but I don't think there's much of a stockpile. I don't think there's much availability.
I think people outside of China are looking at this possible wave and wondering whether it's going to impact other parts of the globe. What do you think?
Well, certainly in China, there's a lot of people. There's more than a billion people living in China. So if there's any large epidemic with a new strain, of course, something could happen. But remember, in the rest of the world, COVID's been circulating for 2 years now fairly easily with Omicron BA1, BA2, and then all the subvariants since then. But realistically, around the world, not much is being done anymore to stop the spread of infections. We're prioritizing the prevention of severe disease with vaccines and with antiviral treatment. So I certainly don't blame China for not trying to stop what's happening at the moment, because in other parts of the world, that there's not much effort to stop transmission either. And I have to say, around the world, we've actually lost a little bit of our surveillance intensity on COVID. Not so much testing's being done, not so much virus sequencing's being done now. as in the past, and we could be caught unawares by something new. I don't think there's a high chance it would come out of China. It could come out of anywhere in the world, actually. And we want to know sooner what we're dealing with in case we have to make additional preparations, maybe have an extra round of booster doses, maybe get more antiviral stockpiles. So we have to keep a close eye on this virus.
Ben Cowling is a professor of epidemiology at the University of Hong Kong School of Public Health. He joined us today from Reading, England, to tell us about a new wave of COVID infections in China. Ben, thanks very much.
All right.
Rock and roll lost an icon this week. Tina Turner, known for her incredible vocal range and electrifying presence on stage. She died at her home near Zurich, Switzerland yesterday at the age of 83. Turner spent half a century in the limelight, an incredible run. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on how her legacy spans the globe.
Though Turner's music career began in the States in the late 1950s, many people around the world first took notice in 1966. That's when the Rolling Stones invited Turner, with her singing partner and then-husband Ike Turner, on a tour across the pond. It introduced the duo to a global audience and came with major commercial success. Behind the scenes, though, Turner battled an abusive marriage and later split from Ike and the band. She released some music right after the divorce, but Private Dancer, which came out in 1984, made a clear statement. Tina Turner is back.
I can't stand the rain against my window.
She performed a bunch of hits from the album at her now famous 1988 show in Rio de Janeiro. More than 180,000 people showed up, and to this day, it remains one of the largest concert audiences for any single performer. Turner also has a huge swath of fans in Australia, who have latched on to her 1973 song, Nutbush City Limits, named after a Tennessee town. Somewhat inexplicably, fans down under crafted choreography to go along with the song. Some say the Nutbush, as it's called, looks like a mix between line dancing and the Macarena. It's become Australia's unofficial national dance, and today, schools across the country paid tribute to Turner by having students do the moves.
Sing along if you know the words.
While most people across the globe will remember Turner for her music, some folks in Switzerland will think of her as their neighbor. Turner moved there with her longtime partner in the mid-1990s. She eventually became a Swiss national and gave up her U.S. citizenship. The singer told talk show host Larry King one reason for the move in 1997.
Basically, Europe has been very supportive of my music.
More than America?
Yes. Yes, hugely.
Hugely more. Yes. You're a major star here. You're a superstar in America.
Not as big as Madonna. I'm as big as Madonna in Europe.
But she is also said to have retreated to Switzerland for a more private existence. Locals let her live a normal life and will miss her being part of the community. Outside her home near Zurich this morning, one resident told Reuters he was slightly devastated.
She's been a part of my life for 35 years now, and she was a good neighbor. She showed up in town. She was very well liked.
Switzerland's president, Alain Berset, expressed his condolences on social media. He called Turner an icon and said her songs will always be remembered. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
It has been hotly debated, and now it's happening. Japan is set to release over 1 million tons of treated nuclear wastewater from the devastated Fukushima nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean. The plan was announced 2 years ago as the best solution following the plant's meltdown in 2011. It is a controversial move and has especially upset Pacific Island nations. Reporter Ashley Westerman has more.
March 1st is Nuclear Victims Remembrance Day for victims of nuclear testing across the Pacific. But this year, the issue seemed a bit more current. This demonstration by students of the University of the South Pacific in Fiji was captured on social media. Betty Rekule, a nuclear justice advocate, was there. She's originally from the Marshall Islands, where she says she grew up learning about the Pacific's nuclear legacy.
Especially
In the Marshall Islands, where 67 nuclear bombs were tested.
Including Operation Castle Bravo on Bikini Atoll in 1954, the first test of the hydrogen bomb by the U.S. It ended up being 1,000 times more powerful than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
And so hearing about more nuclear waste and nuclear issues happening was really shocking to me because I thought all of those things were part of the past.
She's talking about Japan's plan this year to release treated nuclear wastewater into the Pacific. That was supposed to happen this spring, but was delayed following a visit by a delegation of Pacific Island leaders to Japan in February.
It opposes our worldview that people should live in harmony with the environment and the ocean.
Rikule says the impacts of that nuclear testing on the Marshallese people has been vast and intergenerational. And she's not just talking about devastated fisheries and cancerous health effects.
They are deeply affected because of how dehumanizing it feels to have your people regarded as like test subjects.
The Tokyo Electric Power Company, which owns the Fukushima nuclear power plant, says the water is safe to release into the Pacific Ocean. Japan's Prime Minister Yoshida Suga supports the plan. Here he is in 2021 at a press conference, speaking through a translator for Australia's ABC.
Taking care of the treated water is an unavoidable obstacle in the process of the decommissioning of the nuclear plant. We will make sure to secure the safety level way over the benchmark.
Officials say the wastewater would be released gradually over 40 years, not all at once. But many scientists are concerned.
Their argument that this is dilution. We used to joke that the statement was the solution of pollution is dilution.
That's Robert Richman, a biologist with the University of Hawaii. He is one of five scientists from around the world commissioned by the Pacific Islands Forum to study the effects of releasing the nuclear wastewater.
And if the ocean were a sterile aquarium with glass walls and no life, the dilution in the chemistry works.
But the ocean is not a sterile aquarium. And Richman says Japan has not provided evidence that harmful elements won't bind to ocean sediment and life forms, such as fish and people.
To this point, we are unanimous in our view that this has not been proven to be safe.
Richman says releasing nuclear wastewater into the ocean will affect those beyond Japan's borders. Joey Tao is with the Pacific Network on Globalization based in Fiji, over 4,500 miles away from Japan.
Everyone's reliant on the ocean, and it's just like you destroying your home. And when you don't have a home to stay, you'd be really unhappy.
TEPCO earlier this year agreed to delay the plan to study its effects further. Tao says he would like to see Japan taken to task by larger countries, countries like France and the U.S. who led the traumatizing nuclear tests in the Pacific decades ago.
And America needs to come back and take responsibility. It is an ally of Japan. You know, it needs to intervene.
Meanwhile, Tao says the people of the Pacific haven't really been consulted on the plan, a blow to a region working hard to redefine its relationships with the world. Activist Betty Rikule says the issue has put Pacific Island nations in a bind because they, of course, want to work with Japan on other issues.
The government can only say so much without damaging any relationships. It just feels so frustrating to me because I don't really see any place for diplomacy when we're talking about people's human rights, health, and survival.
But she says it's turning out to be a repeat of history all over again. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Batangas, Philippines.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Music fans in Ukraine will be familiar with Vopli Vidoplasova. The rock band's esoteric name comes from a novel written by the great Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky. The band's roots are deep in Ukraine, going back more than 35 years. Recently, as The World's Daniel Offman reports, the original members of the group rediscovered a moment from their early musical glory.
Vopli Vidoplasova's original bass player still looks the part, with his disheveled rocker hairstyle and a jean jacket, denim on denim. His name is Oleksandr Pipa, but that's not what his friends call him.
There are some diminutives, like Sasha, Ukrainian one is Sashko. Some friends call me Shurik, so you pick.
Today, Pipa is in his late 50s. He first got into music at the age of 5.
In the countryside, Ukrainian countryside, in the village, there was a band playing on weddings, and I spent the whole evening by the drum set. just watching the drama play.
Pipa later went to music school and picked up the violin. That only lasted, though, up until he learned about rock music.
I read about it in the Soviet newspapers, articles about how bad life in the West is and how awful hard rock and punk rock are.
Deep Purple and Queen were a couple of his big early influences, but getting a hold of new rock music in 1980s Ukraine was not so easy.
There was a black market for records. Policemen were chasing, and the records were ridiculously expensive. So their procedure was to buy a record together and to re-record it on a reel or cassette.
An underground rock scene was beginning to emerge in Kyiv. By that point, Pipa was playing the bass, making connections with the original members of Vopliviða Plyasova.
Someone suggested us to see a great singer, Oleg.
Hi, everybody. I'm Oleg Skripka. I'm a rock musician, so I started to play in the rock band Vopliviða Plyasova. We are the first band which started to sing Ukrainian rock songs.
Oleg Skripka became the lead singer. We met in the back room of a Kyiv restaurant, and he talked about the band's early days.
Our popularity started with the song Tansi. When we played this song, it was like explosion. Oh, people, they came crazy.
Раз, два, три, четыре! Лягає день, і дає свої надії ночі.
That time, all bands in Kyiv were trying to imitate Russian bands. All bands except us. So when we started to sing in Ukrainian, we instantly became legends and stars, and it was time to record.
Приходьте, люди, на вечір у клуб. Там будуть...
Танці became the title track of the 1989 album that the band recorded in one night.
We recorded very quickly. In this time, you have to do very quickly. You have no money to pay the recording. So you ask friends. You are looking for possibilities.
Танзал запрошує нас. У клубі були любі танці.
The album was a huge hit. People would copy it, share it with friends, or sell it on the black market.
Політичний рок-н-рол.
This tune, Політрок, according to Skripka, was a satirical song about Soviet politicians.
It was also about nothing. So it's Politrock, it's like speech of political men. It's about nothing, really zero.
Oleksandr Pipa says that tune captured the spirit of the times.
How can you live in the Soviet Union and sing about the fact that communists are bastards? It's like thinking about that sky is blue, water is wet, communists are bastard killers. It's understood. This song is kind of like a parody on those satirical political songs.
This tune, called There Were Days in English, takes aim at a flowery Soviet-era style of songs about cities.
The sound of the song, it's like normal rock song of 80s. But on the words, it was Soviet romanticism. Absolutely unreal. It doesn't exist in life, really.
Vopliviða Plyasova kept on rocking through the 90s and the early 2000s. The band toured Europe and recorded new hits, but eventually Pipa says he and Skripka had a falling out.
Typical mistake is trying to explain why you left the band. Of course, I can spend hours trying to tell why I left the band, but I know that the band, its music is great.
And a new generation of fans thinks it's great too. In 2019, a professor from Bard College, Maria Sanovitsky, was working on a book about the album Tansi. That's when Pipa dug up the original recording.
So I gave it to Maria. She took it and flew to the United States, found the studio. And then the mastering engineer, really, he made it even better than it used to be.
Last month, the album Tansi was re-released. Pipa says that hearing those old recordings after so many years was a welcome distraction from the war in Ukraine.
Kyiv was under constant missile attacks from Russia. On one hand, there's a horrible war, and at the same time, some connection to normality. And it made me kind of feel that everything's going to be okay.
Oleksandr Pipa has his own band now called Attractor, and Oleg Skripka is still the frontman for Vopli Vidoplyasova. For the world, Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
From punk rock to the political anthems of pop stars to classical music soaring to the balconies of the Odessa Opera House, our coverage of the war in Ukraine has also captured the role of artists making music when their country's at war. Listen back to those stories and the music. It's all for you on our website, theworld.org. School is almost out for the summer, but if you are an international student in the U.S., then we have one more assignment for you. Promise it won't be a struggle. Tell us about your experience studying in the United States. Has it been what you hoped for? What are the upsides and downsides about going to school in America? Did you like it enough to stay in the U.S.? Record your thoughts about your time as an international student in the States and email that voice memo to myworld@theworld.org. Tell us your name and location, and you might be featured on the show. Again, that email, myworld@theworld.org. In Freetown, Sierra Leone, a nation mourns for the loss of a centuries-old tree.
I'm going to expect to see it. Every time I don't see it, it's going to be a reminder of what's lost.
The historically symbolic cotton tree in Freetown was toppled by a rainstorm, and it's changed the skyline of the city. Also ahead, women artists take center stage in a revamp at London's Tate Museum. Still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Increasingly, tech companies around the globe are asking themselves this question. Where are we going to get our chips? Microchips that make the modern world turn. This week, Apple inked a deal to buy American-made chips. That is huge because for a long time, most microchips have been made in Taiwan. Part of the reason behind the frantic hunt for chips, the tense rivalry between the U.S. and China, which is causing growing uncertainty to tech supply chains. Paul Triolo follows Chinese tech and policy at the Albright Stonebridge Group. In a conversation with The World's Jason Margolis, Triolo told us there are good reasons why Apple and other American tech companies are now turning to new U.S. chip makers.
It has to do with China, but not necessarily with direct competition in the semiconductor space. It has to do with the concern that with all this concentrated capacity for advanced chips in Taiwan, in the event, God forbid, of a military confrontation over Taiwan and the potential cutoff, for example, of access to those high-end manufacturing facilities in Taiwan, you know, this would be really bad for Apple, for Qualcomm, for NVIDIA, for all the companies that use these facilities in Taiwan to make their most advanced chips. But, you know, these are 10-year time horizons for the industry. And so we'll know, for example, if the U.S. effort has succeeded by towards the end of the decade.
The Biden administration is restricting sales of some computer chips to Russia and China. Why? What is the White House afraid of exactly?
The U.S. government is saying we don't want either China or Russia to have certain kinds of semiconductors. Now, for Russia, it's more about the very direct use of those semiconductors in military systems, platforms like drones or command and control systems, communication systems in Russia. In the case of China, it's a little, since we're not in a conflict with China, and hopefully we won't be, it's more about the long-term effect of Chinese companies having access to the latest technology for things like artificial intelligence and high-performance computing. Now, some part of those chips that the U.S. has restricted could be being used in China in supercomputers that can design advanced weapon systems. And so this is what the U.S. is solving for, if you will, in the case of limiting chips going to China from companies like NVIDIA that make these big GPUs, these graphics processing units that you might see in your gaming system. It turns out that those are really good for running AI algorithms. And so there's a lot of concern in the U.S. about China getting ahead in artificial intelligence or having this very high-end capacity to do to design weapon systems using advanced semiconductors.
Right. And in the short term, China has its own cards to play. It's escalated its game. It recently banned a U.S. chip company, Micron, from selling its chips in China. So what's the end game here?
That's a great question. So, yes, you mentioned the Micron case. So Beijing there, China was reacting in part to the U.S. export controls that came out last year that controlled these chips and controlled manufacturing equipment. And I think the Chinese see the U.S. CHIPS Act, the funding of domestic onshore manufacturing, and these export controls as attempts to decouple China and Chinese semiconductor industry from the global ecosystem. And that accounts for why they're taking these actions, such as they have against Micron. But you ask a great question, which is, what is the end game here? Right now, it's a little bit worrisome for the industry. For example, you had Jensen Huang, who's the CEO of NVIDIA, issue some sort of cautionary statements on this, because his concern, for example, was that if you, to the extent that you cut off China as a market from, you know, leading U.S. tech companies, you're going to really damage the overall semiconductor industry. So he's calling for some restraint on some of these controls to avoid a situation where China is more and more cut off as a global market for these leading companies.
Why should we be concerned about this war between China and the U.S. and shifting factories back to the U.S. or not shipping products to China? Why should we care?
You should care because if some of these worst case scenarios play out where we do get more decoupling, we're going to have this real degradation of the sort of innovation cycle that has allowed you to have this iPhone for, let's say, less than $1,000 with this amazing amount of capacity, right? I mean, the cameras and the, think of what you can do with an iPhone now that you couldn't do even 10 years ago. All that is because of the global semiconductor industry being sort of open and free and being driven by market requirements. Now we're in an era where governments are intervening with industrial policy, trying to move manufacturing around. And so the danger is that all this results in a sort of innovation kind of coming to a screeching halt, or at least at a minimum, driving up the cost.
Less cool gadgets that cost more. I think you have our attention. Paul, thank you so much for explaining this to us.
Great to be with you today.
Paul Triolo follows Chinese tech and policy at the Albright Stonebridge Group. He was speaking there with my colleague, the world's Jason Margolis. One of England's top museums has gotten a makeover. The Tate Britain houses 500 years of British art and was founded in 1897 when Queen Victoria was on the throne. This week, the museum opened its doors to reveal a brand new look, a complete rehanging of its permanent collection. Some works have gone into storage. Others are having their moment in the sun. As the world's Sarah Birnbaum reports, that includes more women artists than ever.
In the documentary Women Art Revolution, filmmaker Lynn Hirschman Leeson stands in front of the Whitney Museum of Art in New York and asks people coming in and out to name three women artists.
Who's a woman artist?
Frida Kahlo.
Yay. That's one. Yeah?
Frida.
They couldn't do it.
I need two more women artists.
Two more women artists.
Yes. A female.
As a corrective to this black hole when it comes to women artists, the Tate Britain rehang puts them front and center. Alex Farquharson is the director of Tate Britain.
It's not to say the most celebrated male historic artists aren't there, not represented in depth. They still are. It's that with this rehang, we've broadened the story, including to give proper due to the achievements of women artists in different historic epochs.
The revamped galleries showcase women artists from the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, including some who have never been shown at the Tate before. For instance, the second gallery of the museum is hung with grand Baroque portraits.
Portraits of the great and the good, the elite of the day, often courtiers.
And now something different. A painting of a man standing against a plain brown background, shirt open around the neck, hair loose. This is a painting by Mary Beale, and it's of her husband, Charles. Mary Beale was part of a small band of professional female artists working in London from the 1670s to the 1690s. Beale made enough money painting to be the breadwinner of her family.
Charles B. was her studio manager, so her husband worked in the service of her art practice, which is, you know, quite remarkable.
I was an undergraduate
in the early 80s, and the survey books had zero works by women artists.
This is art historian Amelia Jones. She's a vice dean at the Roski School of Art and Design at the University of Southern California.
So no, we didn't learn anything about women artists of any kind from anywhere.
Let alone someone like Mary Beale. Jones says women artists were excluded from museums and the art history textbooks for centuries.
I think the reason is pretty clear, that in European-based cultures, in Western patriarchy, women were not seen as capable of making art.
They faced all kinds of obstacles. They weren't allowed to go to art school. Then they weren't allowed to draw nude models. Jones says, sure, there were some who bucked the trend, who managed to make art and earn a living.
But those works would never end up being appreciated or incorporated into the understanding of that period.
Gender inequality in the arts still exists, but things have gotten much better since Jones was a student. Emerging female artists are landing solo shows. Long-neglected women artists are getting retrospectives. In the UK, museums from the Manchester Museum to the National Gallery London and now Tate Britain are rehanging their permanent collections to spotlight women artists and artists of color. This is not without controversy. One headline this week blared, "Tate goes woke." But museum director Alex Farquharson says art history isn't, nor should it be, static.
You know, it's an opportunity to set out the art history we're responsible for, the amazing collection we have, in a new way for new audiences and for different times.
As you move into the Tate's 20th century galleries, the number of works by women starts to surge. By the time you get to the contemporary galleries, 50% of the art is by women, from rising stars like London artist Rachel Jones to the elder stateswomen, if you will, of the British art world, people like Linda Sterling, who is only now getting her proper due.
Suddenly, my generation is very fashionable, and there's more and more of us, thankfully, in 50-plus, being discovered for the first time or being rediscovered or being seen through a more contemporary lens.
Linda, she goes by one name, is a feminist punk musician and photo montage artist who came of age in Manchester in the 70s and 80s. Her series of 14 black and white photos and text panels is now up on the wall at Tate Britain for everyone to see. It's called She, She.
So the work She, She I made in 1981, which is 42 years ago, if my maths are correct, to accompany a release of a cassette. And I truly didn't dream then that those same works would be acquired by Tate. It was the furthest thought in my mind.
Linda says early in her career, when she was just figuring out what she wanted to do with her life, she could have used some female role models in the visual arts.
If I'd walked into Tate Britain in 1970 and I'd seen lots and lots and lots of women artists, or those who identify as women artists or queer artists, it would have made a deep, deep, deep impression upon me and perhaps accelerated my path towards becoming an artist.
At least now, Linda says, with this rehang and other efforts like it, young women can have that chance she never did. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
A hero's welcome today in Kathmandu, Nepal, for Sherpa Kami Rita. The 53-year-old set a world record this week. He has summited Mount Everest more times than anyone else. 28 times Kami Rita has stood on the roof of the world. It's actually the second time in 1 week the intrepid Sherpa set that record. He made his 27th ascent of the world's highest mountain just a few days earlier. Kami Rita is now officially one of the greatest mountain guides of all time. This comes as no surprise to many in the mountaineering community who know him. He says his goal is not to compete for any records, but to help his foreign clients scale the mountain. This Monday marks the 70th anniversary of the first ascent of Everest by Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. Kami Rita first climbed Everest in 1994 and has reached the summit nearly every year since. He says he has no plans to retire. Summer is almost here, and many people in Europe and from around the world will flock to the warm beaches of the Mediterranean. For those with disabilities, access to the sea has been difficult. In Greece, an effort is underway to change that. The country is making hundreds of beaches more accessible for people with disabilities as part of a wider project including neighboring countries of Italy and Cyprus. To tell us more about this good news is Yannis Vardakastanis. He's president of the National Confederation of Persons with Disabilities in Greece. Yannis, the country is installing these free-to-use wheelchair-accessible motorized ramps. Tell us more about this technology. I know it's called C-Tracks, and they're kind of ramps that take a wheelchair down to the beach. Can you describe it further?
It's a system. The person with a disability goes on a wheelchair that goes on track into the sea. And when it reaches the level of the sea that the person can go in safely, the person goes in. The chair is waiting there in the sea. And the person, when it goes there and with the remote control, goes back.
I mean, I've seen some beaches in the U.S. where there are kind of rubber mats that allow wheelchair users to get to the water. But this system in Greece runs on tracks and is motorized through solar power. It's pretty cool. Before this project, Yannis, what was the situation like for people trying to get to the beach to enjoy it in Greece in a wheelchair?
It was terrible. There was, for many years, just a beach in the Attica area outside of Athens, accessible. In our country, we have a very strong disability movement. And we started around 20 years ago, a very strong campaign to make the beaches of Greece accessible to Greeks, of course, with disabilities, and to those who visit our country, thousands every year. Although we were protecting this, we were also fighting against it because we were saying that freedom of movement, exercise of the right to recreation, to tourism, means that persons with disabilities should go where all people go. I hope that Greece will be able to give to the Greeks and to those who visit Greece many other beaches accessible, like we have done for the Acropolis. The Acropolis nowadays is a fully accessible archaeological monument.
I want to note, Yannis, that you've also been the president of the European Disability Forum since 1999, in addition to your work on the national level in Greece. Where does Greece rank, in your mind, compared to other countries in terms of dealing with the rights of people with disabilities?
Greece had to go through two wars, through civil war, through dictatorships, through many problems. So if I compare Greece with Sweden, comparison doesn't give the real level of development of a country. I think, to be fair, we are in the middle in the European Union. We are 27. We should be around 10, 11, that level.
So beaches are one area the Greek government has been working to improve accessibility. I'm wondering if there have been improvements in other areas. What about areas that just benefit Greeks, not tourists?
We have seen improvement everywhere, but we know that accessibility is a chain. And if the chain is broken, then accessibility stops existing. So to have accessibility, it means that you have accessible house to live in. You have accessible transport to go out from the house, take the transport to go wherever you want to go, to a restaurant, to a theater, the park, etc. So it's a chain. We have done things. We have very good legislation in the country, but a long way to go. Because the infrastructure of not only of my country, but also of other countries, was not made accessible years ago. It takes time, effort, commitment, and political will.
Yannis Vardakastanis is president of the National Confederation of Persons with Disabilities in Greece. Thank you so much for being with us and describing this project.
Thank you for the opportunity to describe this project and to talk about what is happening with our rights in my country.
If you've ever been to Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, it's impossible to miss the city's famous cotton tree. The sprawling green tower stood watch over Freetown for centuries. Nobody knows how old the tree was, at least several hundred years old. Last night, the cotton tree fell over during a heavy rainstorm. Soon after, hundreds gathered to mourn the loss. Commonly known as a kapok tree, it was a historic symbol of Freetown. To discuss the significance of the tree and what this loss means is Vicky Rameau. She's a TV host and producer of the podcast Make Sierra Leone Famous. So you grew up in Freetown. What does it mean to you today, just personally, that this tree is not standing anymore?
So I have a 7-year-old son who just last week
asked me, what is Sierra Leone famous for? Because he's growing up outside of Sierra Leone and he's in the third grade and he wanted to share with his other third graders something very cool about Sierra Leone. Mm. And initially I said diamonds, but I was like, yeah, 7-year-olds don't really care about diamonds. And so I actually told him the story of the freed people who came to settle in Freetown. And I told him about this tree and I wrote a blog about it just last week. And he was like, well, you know, next time we go to Sierra Leone, can you take me to the tree? And I said, yes. It's heartbreaking. I know for people, it's like, it may just be just a tree to them. But for us, it's our identity, it's heritage, it's community, it's family, it's so much more. It's walking home from school, you know, in the afternoon and walking past a tree with like hundreds and hundreds of bats and the sounds of their wings, being afraid that they might poop on you. It's just always there. It's like right. If the Eiffel Tower wasn't there, or the Statue of Liberty wasn't there, you know, it feels like an amputation, right? Because this is a huge towering. If you haven't seen it, it's hard to imagine, but it's like this huge, tall, big canopy that just covers. So even if you don't look at it, you feel its shade. That cover is no longer there. Those birds are gone. You know, like sometimes they say that when people lose a limb, you kind of keep reaching for the limb because your brain still thinks it's there. I think for a lot of people, it's going to take a really long time for myself to come to terms with the fact that it's not there. I feel like if I walk by, I'm going to expect to see it. I'm going to lift my head to see it. And every time I don't see it, it's going to be a reminder of what's lost.
Well, you mentioned it's kind of like, you know, Sierra Leone's Eiffel Tower, and it was a Sierra Leonean poet, Umar Farouk Sisse, who wrote that the tree was the country's Eiffel Tower, Statue of Liberty, and Big Ben rolled into one. Who planted the tree? Do we know that?
Freetown was originally founded by freed slaves from the U.S. and Nova Scotia and other parts of Africa and the Caribbean. So when we were growing up, we were taught that like the freed people plant, because it's a cotton tree, right? So when you think about it, that freed slaves who had been picking cotton would come to Africa and plant a cotton tree. But I feel like historians have proved that the tree was already there when the settlers got there and it was their first gathering place. And like basically they got off the ship, the tree was there, they stood on the tree and they said a prayer. So the tree is older than anyone knows. The settlers came to about 238 years ago. So it's centuries old. This tree, it's older than Sierra Leone. It's older than more than any of us can remember.
So cotton tree, I mean, it's a kapok tree and it's got these big pods, right, that when they break open, all this like cottony fiber flies all over the place, right?
Yeah, but it stopped bearing. Its economic lifespan is about 50 or 60 years.
I see, okay.
So no one ever has seen cotton on the tree.
Just bats.
Exactly. What we know for it is like lots of birds and lots of bats. There's a sound of like the migration of the bats at the end of every business day as the sun sets on Freetown. And let's say if you're on a high building, like my mom used to work at an old foreign affairs building. And so if you're on a third or fourth floor, you see all these bats either leaving the tree or coming to the tree as the sun is setting. So that's just like a big, you know, it's like a visual, it's an experience. The cotton tree also sits right in the center of town. It's next to the Supreme Court of the High Court of Sierra Leone. It's next to the National Museum. It's also next to the State House, which would be the equivalent of the White House. It's the president's office. I cannot emphasize enough how it really is the heart of the city.
I mean, the tree was depicted on stamps and on currency.
Everything, T-shirts. You have so many companies. It's like the most common thing for like somebody starting a company. You'd be like cotton tree. You know, if you want it to be identified as Sierra Leonean, you'd call it Cotton Tree Foundation, Cotton Tree Magazine, like cotton tree everything. So it's really that symbolic. Yeah.
Is it also kind of a gathering place? Did it serve that purpose?
Yes, yeah, so it's an interesting gathering place. It's a kind of place where you would have maybe street performers performing on the side. You might have beggars. You know, at some point we have like displaced people in Freetown right after the war. They used to find shelter there. But it's a meeting point. So I would say it's less a gathering place than a meeting point. Like if you say, meet me at the cotton tree, everybody, like it's, I will find you, right? If we meet at the cotton tree, I will find you. So it's definitely not a place that people go and gather. But it's, you know, if you're going into town, you know you're at the heart of town once you hit the cotton tree.
It may be too soon to ask, but what are the hopes of people in Freetown for the place where this tree once stood?
Oh my God, it's not too soon. People are already giving opinions. Some people are talking about building some kind of monument that can be some big landmark in the middle of the city. And the president actually tweeted yesterday that, you know, he would make sure that whatever was put there would be something that would continue the symbolism, right? I really just feel like the only way to replace this tree is with another tree, as the same species. Either we're letting the trunk stay there and see what it sprouts, maybe in a year or two, we don't know. Or if we're going to excavate it, I really hope that what happens is plants to put another tree, another cotton tree. You know, one thing I believe, you know, I'm a plant mom, and sometimes, you know, my plants die at the top and I think all hope is lost, but somehow because the roots are there, I just leave them and, you know, something new shoots up. So I'm really hoping. We need it. You know, Sierra Leone, sometimes, you know, we've had so many bad things happen to us collectively, and we're underdogs, you know, it's like how I like to tell it. And, you know, this idea of the tree having such deep roots and being able to sprout anew and have new branches is something that I'm holding on to, because at this moment, I feel like I definitely need something. I need to believe that this isn't it.
Vicky Rimo is a TV host and producer of the podcast Make Sierra Leone Famous. She joined us today from Accra, Ghana. Vicky, great to meet you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nanabil Harris Studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we will see you again tomorrow.